Hey kids, do you like wrestling? Well, we like wrestling too. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Myself and Chris Novembrino kind of doing a lazy river of wrestling criticism, going through the news and whatever happened in stateside television wrestling. And also, you know what? Sometimes we just like to watch old stuff and talk about that too. Love for you to give us a listen if you haven't already. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast. I am your host, as always, Jesse Collings. I am once again flying solo for this episode. I think the explanation for that is that I have no friends. Just kidding. I have had a couple of ideas floating around for episodes, but they haven't quite come together yet. I'm still working out some scheduling conflicts with some different people, but I will have a new episode with a first-time guest should be out next week, but I wanted to provide at least some content for my loyal listeners. I know it's been a couple of weeks, and so I figured I would do a solo episode. I have a few topics written down. I'm kind of going to lift a gimmick from Bill Simmons here. Bill Simmons sometimes does like a six-pack of different topics where he just kind of has six different topics he's going to talk about, usually about sports or pop culture. I have six wrestling topics right here that I want to kind of get into. So I figure I will go over them and hopefully everyone enjoys the conversation. The first topic I have is I want to talk briefly about these WWE press conferences. I've talked a lot about them over the years. There's been a lot of discussion about them. There's been a lot of criticism for them. And I think we're at a point where I think everyone needs to realize that we just need to stop complaining about these press conferences. We need to stop complaining about the questions that are being asked at these press conferences, the kind of content that's being generated from these press conferences. And I know that is contradictory to a lot of my previous statements, but the reality is, no one serious is going to these press conferences. WWE is not credentialing anyone even halfway serious to be in these press conferences. The people asking these questions are fans or people that quite literally work for WWE. The press conferences are now full-on just worked pieces of content, just like the WWE pre-show is with Peter Rosenberg and Booker T and I don't know, JBL, Jerry Lawler. I don't think those guys are still on those pre-shows, but I think you guys know what I'm talking about. That's just what these press conferences are. They are not serious events where people are going to ask real questions to talent or to Paul Levesque. There was a time where that was going to happen. There was a time where, you know, your Brandon Thurston's would be at these press conferences and they would be able to ask, Paul Levesque a serious question, or people would ask things like, you know, what do you think about the Janelle Grant lawsuit? And Paul Levesque would say, I haven't read it. There was a time where that would happen. And when that was the case, I think everything was fair game for the criticism of those press conferences, because it was clear that people who were at least pretending to be serious about being, you know, journalists were attending the press conferences. That's no longer the case. We saw this at WrestleMania weekend. They weren't credentialing anyone that was even halfway serious. It was all just WWE friendly people, or quite literally people that work for WWE that were asking these questions. So they really are just like scripted pieces of content that give the wrestlers, and most importantly, Paul Levesque, a chance to kind of riff and feel good about themselves. So we kind of got to get out of the scope where it's like, oh, these wrestling reporters, they don't ask good questions. That maybe was the case when those reporters were allowed in the press conference, but that's not the case anymore. The reporters aren't allowed in the press conferences. So it's really like complaining about, oh, on the pre-show, they didn't talk about anything interesting, or they didn't talk about anything real in the pre-show. Like, yeah, it's the pre-show. It's just like a piece of vapid content that WWE produces. This is what the pressers are. They're WWE-produced content. AEW pressers, fair game. To my knowledge, everyone is still being credentialed to that. We see real journalists in there asking real questions. Wrestlers respond. Tony Khan respond. They're a little bit more in character than they used to be, for sure. But those are still fair game. But these WWE pressers, where Paul Levesque takes these hand-picked questions, that is absolutely no longer of really any use to us at all. And I will say, Mr. Levesque here, his legacy in these pressers, at least when they allowed real media in, is not good. Has there been... He's as bad as his friend Donald Trump when it comes to handling a question that he doesn't like. This man turned into a complete puddle on like the three occasions that he got asked a real question by somebody. He turned into a puddle when Brandon Thurston asked him about the lawsuit, and he just said, "I haven't read it. I think we had a great weekend here," when the company just got rocked by a massive sexual abuse scandal. When Lucas Sharpio asked him later a follow-up about that, he went on a rant about fake news and you got to go listen to credible sources, because that's not something that's really true. I mean, this guy could not handle any question that wasn't just a complete softball, "Why are you so popular?" like question. And that was really embarrassing. And if the idea is that Paul Levesque is a competent executive in his role, the fact that he couldn't answer any question that involved any kind of level of, quick instincts, media training, being able to pivot onto a question, anything at all, just shows that this guy, I don't think, is cut out for this kind of job. So what do? Let's dumb down the pressers. Let's make sure that Unky Paul can't get any possible question that he could stumble over and embarrass himself. Because whenever that happened, he made sure to embarrass himself. Or he attacked the person that was asking him a question. It was completely pathetic, and he doesn't deserve any of your respect. And anyone that's a serious fan of Paul Levesque should come to grips with that. This guy can't handle any level of criticism. We saw it even when he was going on these like really WWE-friendly pressers in the lead-up to WrestleMania. What is he talking about? He's talking about how he doesn't like fans complaining online. He wishes they could just be fans. He can't handle any criticism that he sees. I mean, this guy is a complete pathetic fool. And he can't handle literally any level of criticism. And if I was working for WWE, I would be thinking, man, this guy is my leader. This guy that turns into a complete jerk anytime anyone confronts him with anything that could possibly be considered, a confrontational conversation. And this guy's supposed to be in charge. It makes him look weak. It makes him look pathetic. And it's, in my opinion, unacceptable for someone to want to expect respectability as a leader and to instead conduct himself like this. And Triple H took a lot of time during WrestleMania to tell us how important he is, how in charge he is, how integral he is to wrestling and WWE success. Yet at the same time, the guy can't answer any questions that might be considered difficult at all without turning into a complete puddle. So that's just something that I have noticed, that we're beyond the point where it's time to complain about these pressers. They're done. They're just pieces of content. We got to move on. There's other issues with wrestling media, but I really don't think we should be complaining about like the quote unquote wrestling media when it comes to these WWE press conferences, because there really are just pieces of content. Moving on to talk about wrestling media a little bit more. I was thinking about this a lot in the fallout of WrestleMania, and we saw what the big takeaway was from WrestleMania, which was Dwayne Johnson ruined WrestleMania, right? Dwayne Johnson was expected to be at WrestleMania. At least people who were analyzing WWE and WrestleMania thought that Dwayne Johnson was going to be at WrestleMania, and then he wasn't. Even though it wasn't really implied that he was ever going to be there, he did that, thing in Elimination Chamber where he helped John Cena turn heel, but then was never mentioned ever again. I can see why fans thought that The Rock might be showing up. I kind of never thought The Rock was going to, just because it was so suspicious how he was never mentioned ever again in any of the promos. So I was never really someone that was thinking he was going to show up, but clearly there was a section of the WWE fans that thought he was going to show up. And the general takeaway around coming out of a disappointing WrestleMania was that Dwayne Johnson ruined it because he didn't show up. And a lot of people think that that's the main takeaway because, fans are protective of Paul Levesque. Fans are protective of his leadership. They don't want to say that his poor creative led to a bad WrestleMania. It's easy to kind of look at what happened in that second night of WrestleMania main event, the John Cena versus Cody Rhodes match, and say, you know what? Dwayne Johnson didn't deliver, and we're going home kind of disappointed. The end of that match was bad, and WrestleMania kind of is coming up, ending on a dour note, and it's because The Rock didn't show up, and The Rock kind of stuck his nose into the WWE creative process and then backed away and wasn't there when they absolutely needed him the most at WrestleMania. And a lot of people would say, oh, it's because the WWE media loves Paul Levesque and they want to be protective of him and all that. And I don't disagree that there's a lot of protectionism going on amongst analysts and wrestling pundits and things like that because of the reputation Paul Levesque has with a certain level of WWE fans. They don't want to make those fans upset by blaming Paul Levesque. So other people get blamed, whether it was Vince McMahon when he was still around. And we went through that whole era where anything good was a Paul Levesque idea and anything bad was a Vince McMahon idea. And now we've got The Rock to kind of be the stand-in to take any bullets for Paul Levesque. But that's actually not why I think a lot of people who were talking about WrestleMania blamed The Rock for WrestleMania failing to succeed. I don't think it's this really cynical, we got to protect Paul Levesque, so let's blame The Rock. I'm going to offer a counter point of view on that. I think the reason people reacted like that is because a lot of people who cover WWE don't understand how to actually like critically analyze professional wrestling or critically analyze WrestleMania. They don't know how to talk ball. That's what it comes down to. How many podcasts out there, and I don't listen to all of them, obviously, but how many serious podcasts are out there that are really diving into the creative aspects of each and every angle leading up to WrestleMania? How many serious podcasts are in there, you know, detailing a match breakdown, talking about what worked, what didn't work, talking about how a character's growth, talking about different storyline, talking about the momentum of what's happening on a product? There's really so few analysts out there. Instead, what we have is a lot of people that just kind of say generic platitudes that kind of constantly kind of are very optimistic, put over the product, whether it's WWE or AEW or New Japan or any promotion. There's so much of this analyst and punditry that goes out there. It's really just very surface level, you know, optimistic, positive, like, yeah, I'm excited about this wrestler. I'm excited about this person. I'm excited about this match, but not really connecting that analysis to anything that I would consider to be anything beyond a surface level assessment of things, right? If we're going to talk about why fans were feeling bad after WrestleMania, the large reason, I can side with the fact that Dwayne Johnson really kind of, and his lack of appearance kind of deflated that main event. I understand why that happened. But you look at the rest of the show, all the other matches that didn't involve Dwayne Johnson at all in the build-up, there was and everyone talked about this leading up to WrestleMania, right? There was, didn't feel hot, didn't feel like a lot of matches were peaking at the right time, didn't seem like there was a lot of stuff on the show that was hot, and that was reflected with the crowd atmosphere. The crowd atmosphere was dead for a lot of those matches because there was not a huge amount of creative investment that was put into a lot of them, and fans didn't feel that. And I wrote a whole article about this on Voice of Wrestling. You know, Paul Levesque failed at WrestleMania. His angles didn't peak at the right time, and the result was a lot of flat stuff happening, and that crept up. And at the end of the day, that main event in night two, which is what most people remember, didn't work. And you could say it's because of Dwayne Johnson. There's definitely a case to be made that his lack of appearance hurt a lot of things. But the build-up to that match was weak. Fans did not feel like they were really hot for it, despite the fact that John Cena had this heel turn and it was this once in a generation kind of moment where John Cena finally turned heel, and there should have been a ton of organic momentum that was happening for WWE at this time. But instead, it just felt cold. Cody Rhodes felt cold. Cena's motivations felt all over the place and less direct. There just wasn't a lot of creative effort that went into this. But how many people would actually be able to assess that? How many people are actually doing kind of the kind of analysis to be able to determine what was going wrong at WrestleMania? That's willing to do the work and to have the insight to tell you, yeah, I think this angle is kind of flat. I don't think that there's a lot of momentum for Jey Uso at this moment. I don't think people feel hot for him. Or, I don't think that this match is really that exciting, or that's going to really hit the way it's supposed to when it's supposed to peak at WrestleMania. The fact is that this was a show, two shows, that didn't have a lot of hot creative going into it. It didn't feel like, and a lot of the wrestlers didn't put in the kind of effort you would expect them to. Like, you watch, like, for just example, the New Day versus Viking Raiders match. That's really just a, both guys working a house show. They didn't have the motivation like they were working a match at WrestleMania. And why should they? Because they got thrown into there at the last second in some sort of promotional-driven tag team match that they booked at the last minute. So it wasn't like they had a lot of motivation, despite the fact that they were wrestling at WrestleMania. So this is a flat show. And I think if you're going to just say, it's Dwayne Johnson's fault, it's The Rock's fault, I think that's super ignorant of everything else that goes on in this company and every other piece of creative that happened. But people harp on that because they don't possess the ability to talk ball. They don't possess the ability to really get in depth on the details and analysis. And the result is they just kind of go with the most instinctual reaction they have, which is The Rock wasn't there in the main event, and that's why WrestleMania was bad. That's maybe why you were disappointed in the main event of night two, but that has nothing to do with almost the rest of WrestleMania, because there was a lot of stuff that didn't work on that on both of those shows. And the reason for that is because there was bad creative and not a huge effort from the wrestlers. I mean, to be honest, just looking at that main event of night two, John Cena and Cody Rhodes are totally skating by on what was a really poor effort, both in the buildup for that match and the match itself. Those guys had what's supposed to be the biggest match in all of wrestling this year. Night two, WrestleMania, world title online, main event. And those guys went out and had a boring-ass match with no creativity, with no extra effort, with no real bells and whistles other than Travis Scott coming down and Cody looking at the belt and maybe thinking about hitting John Cena with it. Those guys did not put in the kind of effort you would expect to see in that kind of a match. And those guys are totally skating on that. Nobody is there providing the analysis like, look, these guys shit the bed. You can say whatever you want about The Rock not making an appearance, but these guys knew The Rock wasn't going to come out. They probably should have known, man, we got to go all out. We got to give absolute maximum effort. We got to let the fans know when they go home that even if they're not getting The Rock, they're going to see a hell of a wrestling match. That is not what they did at all. So it's not just on Paul Levesque. It's on the wrestlers themselves too. But do people possess the ability to actually analyze wrestling like that? And the answer is a lot of them don't. So what did we get? Oh, The Rock didn't show up. The Rock ruined WrestleMania. And it's like, that is not accurate to the entire two nights of WrestleMania. And it's not even accurate for the main event, the match that you want to say that The Rock should have been in. Okay. But people don't know how to talk ball. They don't know the ins and outs of the business. They don't want to speak to an audience that understands that. So we just get this kind of like instinctual reaction to WrestleMania, which is like, there's this one thing, and that's the reason that the show fell apart. And it's like, that has absolutely not the case. And there are people that talk about that. There's a few people that go in and out on it. But there's really not that level of analysis. Like, even Wrestling Observer Radio, and everyone knows how much respect I have for Dave. Like, they're, going to talk about the business of WrestleMania. They're going to talk about, maybe this match wasn't as good or whatever. But they're really not going to get into the nuts and bolts of things. That's why I feel like I have a home on voicesofwrestling.com. It's one of the main reasons that I'm still excited to be a part of this site, years after joining. Because I finally found, not just Joe and Rich, but a group of analysts and a group of listeners, just like yourself, that I think really are willing to understand the nuts and bolts of why a show was good or why a show is bad, or why a match was good or a wrestler is good and why a match is bad or a wrestler is bad. But so much of wrestling punditry these days is just people producing really vapid content. And if you're the kind of person that thinks that, Cora Jade had multiple star-making performances in NXT, and then you're confused why they finally, when they got released her, you're the kind of person that's not going to understand why WrestleMania fell flat. Because you're the kind of person that doesn't possess any level of critical insight into a professional wrestling product. And maybe that's what a lot of people want. Maybe that's what a lot of content should be, because that's what the fans want, because there's not a lot of fans that want to see that insight. That's not what I'm interested in. That's never what I've been interested in. I'm really happy that I have the listenership and the readership that I do have, even if it might be a lot smaller than it was when I was on Wrestling Inc. And that is because I feel like people here really want to get into the nuts and bolts and really understand something. And it's not just this very surface level analysis. And that's what I saw coming out of WrestleMania. I saw this level of really boring surface level analysis that was just attributing everything negative to The Rock. And we're all dumber because that's the narrative that got pushed after WrestleMania. Like, I don't think it's necessarily Levesque and like Levesque's people pushing that out there. I think that might be a part of it, right? People want to protect Levesque's image as a strong creative mind when WrestleMania would suggest that that's not true and that it's easy to find a scapegoat on The Rock. That might be a part of it, but I think a main reason is just a lot of people don't possess the ability or even the curiosity to really fundamentally analyze a wrestling product top to bottom. We got that case, you know, you see that with a lot of AEW analysis too. It's not just a WWE thing. I feel like a lot of the AEW analysis that you see out there is we talk about it being wrong. Like people say, oh, AEW doesn't have stories. AEW's product is too confusing. AEW needs more recap videos. AEW just puts matches together for no reason. All stuff that I think if you're serious about the product, we can all easily debunk. But if you don't possess the curiosity and like the ability to vocalize critical insights into a wrestling product, that is kind of what you're going to say. You're kind of going to fall into some tropes, some things you maybe saw some other people say, or just some really instinctual reactions as opposed to really sitting down and studying a product. And I'm not saying everyone needs to be like that, but I think that's one of the reasons we see a lot of the AEW when we see AEW criticism that we feel like really is not true. A lot of time, and I'm totally guilty of this as well, a lot of time when someone says something about the AEW business or AEW as a company, and we're like, well, that's not true. Like AEW doesn't tell stories, right? Let's use that as an example, right? AEW doesn't tell stories. And I can sit there and I can say, I really disagree with that. And here's why. If you look at the last pay-per-view, we had this story, we had that story, we have this, 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 and that. And like, those are all stories. Those are all matches that culminated in Evolution, blah, 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 blah. And I could kind of debunk that. I think everyone that's listening to this show would understand that. But the reason a topic like that can kind of take hold is because it's being regurgitated by not necessarily super malicious people that are, you know, trolls or grifters, but people that really just don't understand how to analyze a wrestling product. So they'll go with what is the first narrative that they hear. So if they hear something like Cora Jade is a star because she jumped off the top of the NXT War Games cage, people will regurgitate that. They won't go into, well, I don't think Cora Jade's really improved as a wrestler or a promo, and I don't really feel like her charisma is connecting with fans, so I feel like she's not actually being a star. That requires a level of critical insight that people don't have, as opposed to someone that just be like, oh, well, it was a star-making performance. Good job, Cora Jade. Or AEW doesn't tell stories, because that's what I've heard a lot of times, and when I see the matches, and if I'm not really a regular watcher of the product, I don't really know what's going on all the time, so I'm just going to say that they don't tell stories. It might not be accurate, but I don't possess the critical ability to really determine if it's accurate or not, so I'll just say it. And that's why I think a lot of this narrative gets pushed around. It's not always a super malicious, like, troll thing. I think it's honestly because a lot of people just don't possess the ability to really accurately describe or analyze what they're actually seeing. That's ultimately what it comes down to. I think we're giving way too much credit to the average wrestling pundit's ability to really formulate a strong opinion and be able to back that up with strong analysis. I think a lot of this stuff that we hear people say across the board in wrestling is just kind of quick instinctual reactions that people then double or triple down on, not necessarily solid analysis. I think that's reflected across the board, with a perfect example being how quickly people moved to blame Dwayne Johnson for the entire two-night WrestleMania not working out the way they wanted it to, when there was obviously so much more involved. So that is that. Moving into a more positive direction as we switch over to AEW. AEW lately, let's say over the last several months, so we're now starting to see a real trend. I think AEW is in a way better place than it was last year. I talked about this a lot when I did my AEW fan survey, how it seemed like a lot more optimism and positivity has surfaced among AEW fans, and it does feel like the product is back in ways. We're starting to see some positive business trends. We're starting to see a little bit of attendance tick up. We're starting to see ratings be strong. We're starting to see, we never really stopped seeing good pay-per-view numbers, but the pay-per-view numbers have been pretty solid. And we're starting to feel like the promotion is gaining steam again. And we're seeing this kind of, I don't want to call it a renaissance period, but it's definitely, you know, the company seems to be going back up again after a period of time last year and maybe into 2023 where it felt like the company was in a downward spiral. And I think there are a couple key takeaways from that. I think it's really important that AEW has rebounded and gone back up for the long-term way we view AEW. Because I think before this period, you know, I think it probably started sometime around, you know, November of this year, but maybe a little bit after that, or November last year, obviously. So it's been going on for, you know, the last 6 months, we'll say. While that was happening, before that, it just kind of felt like AEW had this period where they were really hot, and then they had Brawl Out, and then we had all this off-screen stuff, and we had some other stuff on-screen that fans weren't really caring for. MJF babyface turn that kind of fell flat. All this kind of, you can point to different aspects of the company that you didn't like over that span. And it felt like, you know, AEW had this good peak. You know, AEW had its launch. Then it had its, you know, it went up and it had its peak, and then it went down. And that was the history of the company. It was like the start, exciting. Then, you know, the pandemic period, which is kind of like a flat part just because there wasn't a lot you can do in the pandemic, even though I think a lot of people felt like the AEW product was still strong despite the atmosphere of the pandemic. But then when they came out of the pandemic, they took off and the company looked like it was reaching new heights. And then everything falls apart and we start seeing them go down, both business-wise and from a quality perspective. But now we're sitting here in May 2025 and we're seeing the company go back up again. And we're seeing this kind of rebound, and we're starting to see the trend line go up. And I think that's really valuable because now we're getting a history of AEW, where AEW, just like any other long-running wrestling company, it's going to have highs and it's going to have lows. There's going to be periods of time where the creative and the wrestling talent feels really strong, and there's going to be periods in time when the wrestling talent and the creative feels not as strong. Every single wrestling company throughout history has been like that. Look at any, like literally any company ever. Look at WWE, look at New Japan, look at CMLL. I mean, CMLL was doing like really well kind of leading up to the pandemic. Then you get Paco Alonso's death. Then you have the power struggle. Then you have the pandemic. Then you have the fallout from that. And CMLL like felt like it was collapsing. It was terrible. They were losing talent. All this stuff was bad, 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 bad. And then the last 2 years or so, CMLL has totally rebounded. They got Mystico back going strong. They got some really exciting new young talent. And all of a sudden, CMLL is back up. And CMLL has repeated that trajectory a million times over 90 years, right? We've seen them have good years and then bad years and then good years and then bad years. WWE, you can say the same thing. New Japan, All Japan, any promotion that's lasted a long time, we've seen the line graph go up, go down, go up, go down. And I'm not just talking business. I'm talking quality. And so I think it's really helpful that we are seeing AEW kind of go up again to let us know that Tony Khan is still capable of producing a really strong wrestling product and that the wrestlers that are on the roster are totally capable of delivering a really strong wrestling product. And so if we hit a point a year or two from now where it feels like the product is going back down again, I hope that there'll be less panic. I hope that there'll be less depression about, oh, I thought AEW was going to be different and now it's not. No, it's doom and gloom. Because what we're seeing is what is normal and what is healthy in a lot of ways for a wrestling company. No wrestling company is just going to have 40 years of greatness. It's going to have a year that's good, followed by a year that's maybe not so good. Or maybe a two-year stretch that's good and then a two-year stretch that's not so good. It's how the wrestling business has worked since it was literally, you know, since the inception of it, or at least since the 1920s. So I think that we're in a much better place because then, not just because the product is better, but I think because we're now establishing a history for AEW, where it wasn't just a peak and then a decline. We're going to see a peak and then a decline, and then we're going to see another peak. And you know what we're going to see after that another peak? We're going to see another decline. That's how the business works. And I just think we're now in a healthier spot because of that. I also think another takeaway I have just from this AEW resurgence in a lot of ways is I think I was talking to John Pollock and Brandon Thurston. I was on Pollock and Thurston last month talking about my AEW fan results, the fan survey results. And John raised a good point where he mentioned, I think the company has finally moved beyond the CM Punk shadow, the whole, you know, CM Punk, the brawl out, the suspension, the return, the firing, then him getting signed by WWE, and that whole cycle created a really vicious, you know, negative narrative around AEW. It was a shadow that was over the entire company. And since time has moved on and since Punk has gone to WWE and he's off in another universe, you know, AEW is no longer the company where I feel like a lot of the intrigue is going on backstage, where we're wondering, oh, there's a power struggle. Oh, who's going to be in charge? Oh, the Young Bucks did this. Oh, CM Punk wanted this to happen. Oh, CM Punk's got his own show, or all of this stuff that was going on. I feel like now the discussions about AEW are much more centered around the product and what's going on with the product. And whether it's praise or criticism, I think that is just like a lot better for AEW in the long run, that they don't necessarily have a lot of behind the scenes drama that we know about. I'm sure there's behind the scenes drama going on all the time. That's always the case in professional wrestling. But the fact that the main discussions of AEW are not revolving around backstage drama. Instead, we're talking about the on-screen product. Like, as controversial and as incendiary the Death Rider storyline might be, as frustrated as some fans might be that that's the main event and that's kind of had a stranglehold over the world title scene for the last several months, that is still criticism aimed at the product. It's there's this main event angle that's not really doing it for me. And I feel like that's a lot healthier than the main criticism for AEW being, oh my God, the backstage is a mess. All these wrestlers hate each other. Oh, the company's falling apart. That stuff's not healthy for the company. I think even the Death Rider criticism and that kind of being the main criticism for AEW right now is a sign of strength, because I think the house is in order in a lot better of a way than it used to be. And even getting rid of, you know, we don't have, oh, where's Ricky Starks? What's he up to? Oh, where's Miro? When's he coming back? We don't have those things hanging over the company either. There are still some people, you know, where is Britt Baker? You know, where is, Keith Lee? Where is he? Like, there's still, you know, Jack Perry hasn't been around, but there's still some question marks about what's going on. But we definitely moved past the, I think, like, oh, is Ricky Starks going to stay with the company? Oh, is this person going to stay or sign with the company? Or are they going to leave to go to WWE? That was additional, like, extra drama I don't think the company needed. Not necessarily there's a lot they could do about that. That's just business. You know, sometimes you're going to have wrestlers you're not going to want to use. Every company's been like that, despite Nick Khan's protest that that is not the case. So I think that's another aspect, too, is that we're the company, the conversations around the company are a lot healthier than they used to be, because they're still centered around the product. Even if it's when it's criticism, it's still criticism of the product. It's not necessarily criticism of Tony Khan or backstage politics or all this kind of stupid bullshit that I personally don't really enjoy talking about all that much. But just in general, I think it's way healthier that the focus, the most fans focus on the company is focused on the product and the wrestlers and, you know, who's getting a push and that kind of stuff. It's not focused on backstage drama and petty politics and, you know, people fighting for control and things like that. A lot of that had to do with the CM Punk stuff, but there was other stuff too, besides that, that I think were kind of rearing its head in an ugly way. And AEW is no longer the company where the stuff that's going on behind the scenes is more intriguing than the stuff that's going on screen. If anything, that's WWE these days. But AEW is now a company where I feel like the most exciting stuff about aspects of the company are happening on the screen. And that's definitely a healthier place for the company to be. Speaking of the Death Rider storyline, I think it's really important that AEW thinks about how do they nail this Moxley title change? Because while I have not enjoyed the Death Rider storyline, and why I feel like it's been annoying that Moxley has been the champion for this long, he hasn't delivered in matches. There's all this interference bullshit in the main events and stuff like that. I haven't enjoyed it. I know a lot of people across the board haven't enjoyed it. Despite that, the fact is, he's been champion for a while. He's been protected. He's been presented as a dominant champion, even if that involves cheating. And the stage has been set for whoever eventually topples him will be given a big momentous moment. Even if I feel like the Death Rider storyline hasn't succeeded in a lot of different ways, I do think that it has succeeded in a way that it's whoever actually does beat Jon Moxley will feel like they will have really accomplished something when they take the world title for him. And that's a successful part of the angle. And so that is a major opportunity for AEW to show its fan base that they're really invested in somebody. But who is that person going to be? And that is the situation. Right now, I am of the belief that that person's going to be Darby Allin. I think that we know about Tony is that Tony is committed to his ideas. He likes seeing things through. Once he has the idea for a finish to a storyline, he wants to get to that finish eventually. And in a lot of ways, that's very admirable. But when something isn't working, he hasn't always pivoted away from it. And Darby's been gone for a long time. He's climbing Mount Everest. He's, you know, presumably going to be back sometime, I think, you know, later this spring or maybe in the early summer. And it seemed like the way the Death Rider kind of formed, the way that, you know, Jon Moxley beat Darby Allin and took his title shot, all that kind of, and ended up winning the world title that way. The storyline seems to be Darby Allin eventually coming back and Darby Allin winning his first ever world title. And in a world, I think that works. I think that Darby Allin could really get over doing that. And you can't say that Darby doesn't deserve it. He's been with the company since day one. He's been one of the most consistent performers in the entire company. He has thrown absolutely everything he's had to getting over in AEW. And I think if he hits the coffin drop on Jon Moxley and he gets the 1-2-3 counts, and he wins the title in this big moment, it will really work for him. I don't think Darby Allin is a bad choice to get that opportunity. But I do think that there is a major question about whether or not he is the right choice. Because you also have Will Ospreay, and you also have Adam Page, and you also have Swerve Strickland. And while I think that Darby Allin would be an acceptable choice to get that kind of moment, beating Jon Moxley for the title, I don't know if it's the best use of that resource. There's more mileage you can get out of Hangman Page winning that title. There's more mileage you can get out of Ospreay. There's even more mileage you can get out of Swerve. I really like Darby Allin again, but who has the most momentum to be a world champion next month or in 2 months? It doesn't feel like it's him. He's been off TV. And it's tough when you look at the work that those three other guys have been putting in and the momentum and how over they are right now. It's hard to look and think this guy that's been off TV for a few months is going to be a better choice than any of those three guys. I don't know who it's going to be. It could be Ospreay, it could be Hangman, it could be Swerve. It could be literally any three of those guys. Probably not going to be Swerve because he had his chance at the last pay-per-view and lost. But we're obviously getting this Hangman versus Ospreay match at the end of the Owen Hart tournament in a few weeks. And the winner of that gets, you know, the title match at, I believe, All In Texas, the stadium show, where you would think there probably be a title change. So that's the reason I would hesitate to say that's Darby, even though I feel like the storyline still calls for Darby to win eventually. It's going to be Hangman versus or Ospreay in the main event of All In Texas. So that would seem to be the kind of center stage where you would want to do such a title change, but you don't have to. So there we're looking at Hangman or Ospreay. And really it's, I know people have strong feelings for Hangman and for Ospreay. I mean, I love both guys. I think both of them would be excellent world champions. You can't go wrong with either choice. I'm not going to get too wrapped up in who they ultimately choose if they were to choose one of those two guys. But those are the guys that I think should probably get the opportunity to dethrone Moxley. Because like I said, this is a really good opportunity to throw momentum behind somebody. And as good as Darby is, and in a lot of ways Darby deserves it, in the long run, is he your absolute tippity-top babyface to lead the company? I'd say it's probably not. You're probably better off with a Hangman, or you're probably better off with an Ospreay. And fans expect it. They expect Ospreay to win the world title. They expect Hangman to get his hands back on the world title again. And there's a lot, you know, a lot you could do. Not to say there isn't a lot you could do with Darby as well, but it does seem like it would be a missed opportunity to, I think, use it on Darby when you could have the opportunity to do it for Page or Ospreay. And you could always rebuild those guys' momentum. You could get eventually put Ospreay and Hangman over. It's not like those guys are going to be dead if they don't get that opportunity to beat Moxley, because they can rebound from pretty much anything. But I do think it would be, you know, a missed opportunity to use it on Darby, as much as I hate to say it, because as I said a million times, I like Darby. I think he does deserve this kind of opportunity, but he's been off TV for months. And we got to talk about what's the momentum right now when the company feels hot. Who is leading that charge? It's Hangman and it's Ospreay. Okay. Darby's been off TV for a while. And sometimes if you got to pivot and you got to ride the hot hand, and that's how a lot of wrestling is. A lot of, you know, there hasn't been a ton of times in wrestling history where, you know, years and years of planning went into making a top star. A lot of times a top star emerges relatively quickly and the promoter rides the hot hand, and that's what ends up happening. So not to say that, like, it's not like there's been no investment in Ospreay or Hangman. Obviously Tony has valued them highly. Hangman's been champion before. Ospreay has been, you know, basically treated like a super main eventer since he first came into the company. So it's not like there's no investment in those guys, but those guys are the hot hands right now, and I would go with one of them. Moving on, this is kind of a fallout from the AEW fan survey I did, but also just in general, I think we, not everyone, obviously, a lot of people see wrestling this way too, but I've been thinking more and more about it lately, and I do think that women's wrestling in general is an opportunity for growth in the industry that too often people are ignorant of. That's a really basic thing to say. I think any advocate of women's wrestling has been making that argument for decades. But I do think when I see things like this Toni Storm character really taking off, and the way that that kind of character can connect with different types of wrestling fans that maybe aren't traditional wrestling fans, that didn't grow up watching WWE or didn't, you know, grow up watching a territory or watching WCW, or they were a tape trader or any type of kind of typical wrestling fan we think of, but maybe someone that's really new to coming to wrestling sees the Toni Storm angle and the drama that comes from that, which in a lot of ways is distinctly feminine. It's kind of hard to imagine a male version of the Toni Storm character. And I think that's really important. It's a very important distinction that this is a bold, distinctly female character, which has been historically completely lacking in professional wrestling. Just to use her as an example, you could say it about other wrestlers too, but I'll just use Toni as an example. And I think that's a way you can reach new fans. And it doesn't mean you have to turn your entire company into like Toni Storm and like other similar gimmicks, but it is a way to introduce new fans to professional wrestling and get them interested, that if they can get into Toni Storm and they can get into things like the Hollywood ending match with Mariah May, then it's not that hard to then see them getting invested in that. And then they're getting invested into a Hangman Page match or MJF match or a John Moxley match or something else. It's a way to reach new fans. And I think for way too long, wrestling has been kind of ignorant in its attempts to reach new fans. It's been built around nostalgia. It's been built around trying to reach fans from previous generations, or just trying to cater towards your existing fan base. WWE, I do think, has done a really good job with their celebrity involvement over the last 5 years or so. When you have a Bad Bunny, you have a Logan Paul, and you have these people that can bring younger fans to back to professional wrestling and have them associate professional wrestling with something cool as opposed to something that's either for really little kids or for people who live in their mom's basement. And it helped change the image of WWE, I think, in a way that made the company feel cooler and hotter. And it did help them build new fans. We talk about it all the time. The WWE fans of today are different than the WWE fans from 5 or 6 years ago. So I do think that that is something to keep an eye on. And I do. So when you're talking about building new fans, I think that women's wrestling is a way that can connect fans. And I think that AEW is now in a position where their women's division is strong enough where you can really push a lot of different types of women's wrestling and not have to worry about losing maybe your more traditional audience. Because I think when AEW first started, part of the issue with the women's division was it just wasn't that good. Didn't have a lot of skilled hands, didn't have a lot of characters, didn't have a lot of people that were over. There was no, you know, female Chris Jericho. There was no female Kenny Omega that could kind of carry the division during the early stages of the company. And so it was tough to, I think, if you couldn't just dedicate a bunch of time to women's wrestling just for the sake of it, because the fact of the matter is a lot of talent that you would have ended up showing during that time period wasn't going to produce at a high level. That's not true anymore. They have a very robust women's division. They have a lot of talented people. They have a variety of different talented wrestlers. And you can use those to push different types of wrestlers, and you can use that to get different types of fans. So when you have someone like a Willow Nightingale, like, you can put Willow Nightingale out there. She could have matches. That really shouldn't offend any of your, like, traditional hardcore wrestling fans that just want to see, you know, people go out there and throw bombs and put each other through tables. Willow Nightingale's really good at that. She's also really charismatic. She's got a lot of great fundamental aspects of pro wrestler. But she's also someone that could reach different types of fans because wrestling has historically not pushed people like Willow Nightingale. And I think there's a lot of momentum surging up for the company to do that. I also think that AEW is in an interesting position too. And women's wrestling will play a vital role in this ultimately. In that we're seeing rapid politicization across the country and almost everything. And we're really in like a cultural civil war in a lot of ways. And WWE over the last decades, but specifically over the last few weeks, has really seemed to throw its cards into the, we are the Donald Trump Make America Great Again company. We got Paul Levesque talking about how much he likes Donald Trump. We got Roman Reigns, their biggest star, talking about how much he loves Donald Trump. Cody Rhodes' character is at least coded as a, you know, conservative MAGA superhero, even though that may not be how Cody actually feels about himself. But we're headed into a space where I feel like almost by default, AEW is going to be seen as the leftist alternative to WWE. And that has already kind of been in place. Just because AEW is a counterculture company. AEW is the upstart trying to challenge the old moneyed monopoly, which, so you kind of naturally have this, you know, historical conservative versus historically progressive company dynamic that's happened since the company first launched. AEW really isn't inherently that much of a political company outside of, you know, some of the wrestlers might say some things like endorsing, you know, progressive policies, or, you know, do show support for different minority groups and the trans community and things like that. I go to those Boston shows in AEW, and obviously Boston, very liberal city, right? But I've heard, you know, other people say this, it's very obvious, like the AEW fan base in Boston, those shows are really gay. Like, those are just very gay crowds. You see the signs, you see a lot of stuff from the audience. It's very, very different than if you go to a WWE show. you know, WWE shows have a lot of kids at it. WWE shows maybe have, you know, different types of fans there, even in Boston. But you go to those AEW shows and it does feel like you're at, like, you know, a progressive rock concert or something like that. And I do feel like we might be reaching a point where AEW, if WWE continues to go down this path where there's like this soft embrace of Donald Trump. I know there was a lot of concern that he might make an appearance at WrestleMania, which he thankfully did not, because that's the last thing we need is that discourse. But it does feel like this company is going, trending more and more toward, WWE is trending more and more towards being a, you know, Trump-friendly company. I think AEW naturally, as the alternative, is going to emerge as the opposition to that. And I think by having a healthy and strong women's division that pushes a wide variety of different types of women, I know, like, on Collision last night, Toni Storm said something like, I'm here, I'm queer, and I'll always be timeless. Like, that line, you know, it's just kind of a throwaway line to some people, but that line means a lot to some other people. And I don't think that's something you would hear on a WWE show these days. And that is going to be a distinction that maybe becomes more prominent going forward. Maybe it doesn't. I kind of hope it doesn't. I don't need, you know, political rhetoric in my wrestling product. I think I'm good. I get enough of that in my shoot job. Trust me. But it's something that I'm going to definitely be keeping an eye on going forward, because as WWE continues to tip the toes into the MAGA end of the pool, I could see AEW. And again, AEW seems like kind of like an apolitical company in a lot of different ways, but because they're naturally an alternative to WWE, and because they've given their, I think, their talent a little bit more freedom to express things like their political views than maybe WWE does, unless you're Roman Reigns. AEW will find itself more on that end of the pool. So that's something I'll keep an eye on. And I think that it is kind of in some ways ties back to women's division, because if WWE has shown some level of neglect from its women's division, and WWE's women's division consists of, you know, the traditionally conservative woman, which is, you know, a blonde fitness model with implants, that is going to be different than what AEW's women's division looks like. And in some ways that is going to become a political debate. So I don't want to get, I know that was just a political discussion and I don't really want this to be a political podcast, but I'm not afraid to wade into that end of the pool. A lot of pool references in that last segment. Last topic, wrestler of the year, or 5 months into the year. I'm recording this on Sunday night. Who is the wrestler of the year so far? Obviously, wrestler of the year, you're looking at drawing power, you're looking at popularity, and you're also looking at in-ring output. And also just kind of a narrative, like, who owned the year? When we think back of the year 2025, whose year was that? And so that's all important to look at. What are we doing right now? I would say that right now my top candidates seem to be more overseas. I think Mystico is obviously a strong candidate. He continues to draw really well in CMLL. The company is entirely built around him. His in-ring output this year, I haven't really noticed as being particularly strong. He's never I think he's a good wrestler. And he's got that babyface Arena Mexico house style down pat. He's definitely not someone who I think is going to win this award based on his in-ring work. I think his in-ring work is acceptable. But his drawing power and his overall popularity continues to be strong. It's almost like you can't go wrong voting for him. When in doubt, vote for Mystico. And I kind of think there is a lot of doubt, because I don't see a ton of super, super strong candidates at this point, kind of outside of Mystico. The other guy that I'd be seriously looking at is Hiroki Goto, which is kind of crazy when you think about it, because I don't think anyone would have thought about that at the start of the year. But Goto has done a lot for New Japan Pro Wrestling and a lot this year. He has been it's been a feel-good year. I think so far, if you were to say, like, what wrestler has kind of owned the narrative of 2025, it's Hiroki Goto. When I think of 2025, I'm going to think of Hiroki Goto. He had the big title win over Zack Sabre Jr., which was going to finish very highly, I think, in a lot of match of the year votes at the end of the year. It's definitely it's in the conversation for my match of the year. I like the Will Ospreay and Kyle Fletcher cage match at Revolution, maybe a little bit more, but those are my top two matches of the year right now as I sit here on May 4th. And so he has the match quality down. He has the narrative down and he's drawing. He just, you know, they just did 5,400 people in Fukuoka he was wrestling Callum Newman. Now, to be fair, that also had the last Naito match in New Japan. So you can say maybe that drew the house. So that's, it probably did. It's probably a bigger deal, but we've seen Goto draw this year. He's Hiroki Goto, the box office. So I think his drawing power has been solid, especially when you consider what the expectations maybe were for his title run. And this does not feel like a gold watch title run where they just put the title on a guy because they're like, you know what, this guy's been around for a while and he's never won the title, so let's just do it. I think he legitimately is the best person in that company to have the title, and he is delivering both in the ring and in the box office. He's been absolutely fantastic this year. It's a feel-good story. I'd probably vote for him. If the ballot was right this second, I'd probably vote for Goto. I think Mystico might actually be a stronger candidate just from a drawing perspective, but it's hard for me to ignore the year Goto has had. The other candidates I would look at Yamato and Dragon Gate. Still kind of the same thing. I mean, I think I voted him third last year. Excellent in-ring work this year. Still champion in Dragon Gate. Just doing a great job being the face of that promotion, driving everything forward, building the main event picture around, kind of everything that you wish the Moxley title run was, which is like, this guy has established himself as a real bar and whoever beats him is going to get a huge momentum boost. It's like that with Moxley, but Moxley's had shit matches, okay? Yamato has had great matches since he won that title. So he remains a strong candidate. What I think is going to happen, he's going to end up dropping that title relatively soon. And then I think his back, there's no way the back half of his year is as strong as the front half of it was. So I think that's going to hurt him in the long run. He's not going to have the kind of back half that I think like a guy like Mystico has, or even a guy like Goto is going to have. Because if Goto holds that title, if he's able to hit that title by the G1 and he's holding that title into the G1, I almost think it's a wrap for Goto, because he's going to have just an incredibly strong year if he continues at this pace. Ozawa and Noah, he is kind of like the new face on the block, right? He wins the title at the start of the year. His stable and everything is built. Noah is entirely built around that. He just main event of the 25th anniversary show at Sumo Hall. So he is definitely someone, he's having good matches. He beat Kenta in what I've heard is a good match. I have not seen that match yet since it just happened yesterday. I haven't gotten around to it. So the momentum for him feels there, and he's definitely like the new kid on the block. Like 2025 was the year that Ozawa was made as a top guy. So he's definitely a candidate. And then if I'm looking in America, you know, I think that this is a weak year in America. Personally, it's not going to be Moxley. We've talked about him and his underperformance. It's hard to make the case really for anybody in WWE. John Cena and Cody Rhodes would be like the two most logical candidates, but Cody hasn't had a great 2025 in the ring for sure. Cena, you know, he's drawn well, although maybe not as well as people expected, especially with this heel run. But Cena's been awful in the ring. He hasn't wrestled a ton, but just anytime he's gotten in the ring, he's just been absolutely the shits, like really, really bad. And it's really tough to win wrestler of the year when you're just a fucking terrible in-ring wrestler. And that's where John Cena is these days. So I just don't see him being able to do it. And then in AEW, you look at it. So the strongest AEW candidate, I think, right the second is Toni Storm. Women's World Champion. She is getting these huge reactions. She feels like she is setting the bar for how popular a woman can be in AEW. She feels like she's the hottest act in the company right now. She has had good matches. I mean, the Mariah May match will definitely get a lot of votes for at Match of the Year. I'm sure she's got other stuff planned. She's got this Monet match coming up where that's probably the biggest women's match that AEW has ever done. And it might be the biggest women's match, you know, in several years at least, across all of wrestling. So she seems like somebody, and Monet's been great. Monet has arguably been better in the ring than Tony. I don't think Monet is as over as Tony is. And I don't think Mercedes is necessarily redefining like a woman star in AEW. She's more just like a very good version of something that we already knew kind of existed. And you could say like, but like in terms of like overall depth of high quality matches, I think Mercedes is definitely ahead of Tony. We're talking about like women's wrestling MVP, but I think there's something about Tony's character work that has really transcended her amongst not just any woman on the roster, but really anyone on that roster period. So I like Toni Storm probably as a US, as the top US candidate, but I just, the way that AEW and WWE have gone, where I think the WWE, the AEW title picture has been kind of in this Moxley vortex, which hasn't really, you know, it's not, no one's getting into the wrestler of the year conversation being in the Moxley vortex. So that hurts kind of. And this is really an award where you start with who has the world title. You start with who's main eventing shows. And if you look at, okay, we look at Goto, we look at Mystico, we look at Yamato, we look at Ozawa, like those are the people that are main eventing shows. And just when you look at the big two US and promotions in WWE and AEW, the people that are main eventing shows aren't getting it done in a lot of ways. So it's still early. I think, you know, the second half of the year is not going to be probably as Moxley dominant in AEW. So I, you know, you could see someone else breaking in, but I would say right now I'd probably go Goto, then Mystico, and then maybe Toni Storm or maybe Yamato. Not sure, but that's what I'd be looking at right now. I'd be curious what other people are thinking. So those are all six of my topics. Thanks for listening to me. Like I said, next week we'll have a first-time guest on the show talking about a big topic in wrestling. So stay tuned for that, and I will talk to you again after a while.
Hey now, it's Mike Gilbert, host of the Mike and JD Show, right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Join JD by God Oliva and myself every Thursday night live on the Voices of Wrestling YouTube channel at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time as we stay up all night discussing all the hottest stories in professional wrestling. You can also check us out right here on the Voices of Wrestling podcasting feed, or you can subscribe to the Mike and JD Show feed. Now, enjoy the show.